Progressive Radio Network.
Well, hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Diana Wiley. And I'm so happy to be returning to have Sherry Winston return to this program. She was on it last February, but she's been on the program a few times. And once again, Sherry Winston, oh, you're just so wonderful. She's a celebrated sexuality teacher, an award-winning author, and a medical professional who brings over, well, I guess it's two decades, maybe more, Sherry, of experience as a certified nurse wife, nurse, midwife, and gynecology practitioner, and also a decade as a sex teacher. I first heard you in Monterey in 2012 and as a presenter at one of our conferences. So glad that you're back on the show, Sherry. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Oh, it's just a pleasure to be here. Always happy to chat with you.
Yeah, well, you're just a fount of knowledge. And your book, which I have recommended to lots of my clients, is Succulent Sex Craft. And people can get that book, I suppose, on Amazon, but also they can get it on your website?
Sure. The easy thing to do is go to Amazon where you can get both of my books. And, so Amazon's easy. Go to Amazon.
Okay.
Go to our website,
okay,
though, because then you get to see all the other good, yummy stuff on our website.
Right. So let's see. The website where they get to see all the goodies, tell us that one.
That's intimatearts.com. Intimate, as in intimacy,
right,
arts, plural, and center spelled the American way.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, Sherry, you and I decided to discuss solo sex, and I know in your book you prefer not the term masturbation. Because I have read your book, I would I know your reasons,
so you
and
know
it's
the answer.
Pretty good. Although masturbation
you know
is used a lot,
word.
But yeah. Mm. So, tell us why you prefer solo sex to or
well,
self-pleasuring
I'll
even.
Tell you. So, right. So I never really cared for the word masturbation anyway. It's there's so much cultural shame that's attached to it. But it isn't even just contemporary culture, because the word masturbation actually means, the Latin root means to pollute with your hand.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so that negativity, that sex negativity and shame goes back so far and so deep. So that's why I started using terms like solo sex. And I have to tell you, I had this woman come up to me after I was teaching a class, and she said, you know, I was at a class of yours 10 years ago, and you said something that changed my life. Which I'm like, great, awesome. Glad I could do that. What did I say? And she said, you used the term solo sex. And she said, that just shifted everything for me, and I stopped thinking about the sex I have with myself as something that's shameful or hidden or not even real, like that it doesn't count. So that reframe, I think, is useful for all of us to start thinking about the sex we have with ourselves as something not just real and valid, but something useful and beautiful. So that's why I call it solo sex.
And I think it's a very good shift in terms. And solo sex is indeed a primary form of sexual expression. And I believe it's not just for kids or for those who are in between lovers or for old people who end up alone, that it's maybe it's an ongoing love affair that each of us has with ourselves throughout our lifetime.
It can be. And I hope it is for a lot of people. I think we still have a lot of those myths in our culture. That it's only for when you're single, which It's not. You can be having sex with yourself even when you're in a relationship. And in fact, I recommend that we do continue our solo sex. And also, it's a great way to start exploring our sexuality. And I particularly encourage this for young women. Generally speaking, young men don't really need extra encouragement. They generally have sex with themselves. It's not as big a cultural shame for them. But young women, a lot of them still, even in this day and age, probably about half of teen women don't self-pleasure. And as when we get older and we get the women in their 20s, more and more women are. But I've had women in classes or clients who, you know, were in their 30s, 40s, or older who have never touched their own genitals in a sexual way. And so they're really, they don't even know where to begin. They don't know, you know, what do you do? What does that mean? And so I think it's really important for us to be encouraging everyone to get into a loving, healthy relationship with their own sexuality by self-pleasuring, whatever your age and whether you have been doing it already or not.
It can be so informative, and it can certainly help women reach orgasm. I've had two over the 35 years I've been in practice. I had several years at UCLA's Female Sexual Medicine Center, and I worked with two female urologists, and we speculated that if a woman had not masturbated as a teenager, probably she did not lay down those neural pathways from the genitals to the brain for orgasm. Mm-hmm. And so for these women, a lot of them really needed a vibrator, something that would go way faster than their own fingers or their partner's tongue or their partner's penis or whatever, to reach orgasm. And there's nothing wrong with that, of course, but yeah, that association with sexual pleasure beginning in adolescence with self-pleasuring is pretty important.
Yeah, and I think what you're talking about laying down neural pathways is important to understand. I do think we can develop our pathways at any time in our lives. Many of the pathways are easier to lay down when we're younger, but we can do it at any point, and then we can expand our pathways. And I think our solo sex is a great, I think of solo sex as our rehearsal hall, as our practice studio, our self-care spa, you know, our classroom where we get to learn, our laboratory where we get to experiment. So to me, it's just like a musician learning to play their instrument. And you wouldn't expect a musician to learn to play their instrument by starting out with duets. You need to learn your instrument, you know, you and your instrument. You need to practice, and that's how you get those pathways. That's how it becomes automatic, so that if you were playing the piano, you know, when you start, you're thinking about what, you know, what keys your fingers are hitting, but at a certain point it becomes automatic. And those are the pathways we're talking about. And anyone can learn to play the piano at any age. It is easier to start when you're younger, though.
Yeah. So we have masturbation as, I think, as a way for all, I'm sorry, I'm going to use the word masturbation just because it.
You, of course.
I just seem to use it more often, but I really appreciate how you use solo sex or self-pleasuring, and I often use that too, but it is a way for all of us to learn about our sexual response. And when I was in California for, let's see, I guess about 10 years, I co-led a group with Dr. Maria Flaherty, two groups, women's sexuality groups, and they'd all had sexual abuse in their, or trauma of some sort in their past. Mm-hmm. And when they joined the groups, they typically were not orgasmic. Mm-hmm. And so we would give homework assignments to them, and that required self-pleasuring. And mm-hmm. some of the women who were very work-oriented, they wanted to use a vibrator so that they could get off in, you know, a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And then we would say, well, try your fingers, because this may be more partner compatible. And a lot of these women did learn to have orgasms, but they had to learn their bodies first. And that's, mm-hmm. isn't that useful with self-pleasuring, mm-hmm. that you learn how you respond.
Mm-hmm. And understand that we train our responses.
Mm-hmm.
By creating those pathways. And so, you know, if you've never played the piano before, the first time you sit down, you're going to feel awkward. It's not going to feel natural. But the more you practice, the easier it becomes, the more natural it becomes. And then you become fluent. And it's the same with our whole mind-body, you know, brain connection, that we need to connect those. I mean, the pathways are there. We're born hardwired for pleasure and ecstasy,
yes,
but if we don't
we?
Use the pathway,
yeah.
it doesn't get developed. The more we use it, the easier it gets to use it.
Sherry, can you just say a little bit more about that? Because I'm such a believer in that too. That we have the capacity. It's in us, but a lot of people shut it down, don't they? But can you say a little more about your experience with this?
Well, you know, before I was a sex teacher, which, by the way, I've now been a sex teacher for 17 years.
17 years.
Yeah,
that
I know.
Makes you a
and
real expert.
World, right? And I was in the world of birth for 25 years before that. So the thing about birth is that mostly I was a home birth midwife, and then a birth center midwife, but mostly home birth. And the thing about home birth and birth itself that a lot of people in our culture don't get is the capacity for ecstasy that the birthing woman can experience. And I know that's a stretch for most people, but we'll set that aside and just say that what we want to create for a birthing woman is an environment where everybody is in alignment with her energy, and everybody is there supporting her and supporting her energy and creating an environment that I would call sacred or reverent.
Mm.
And what happens when babies get born in that kind of environment where it's quiet and peaceful and the lights are dim, maybe she's in a birthing pool and the baby's getting born into the water,
mm-hmm.
but it's a very peaceful, loving environment. And what happens with most of the babies that are born that way is they come out ecstatic. They come out beaming. They're not crying and screaming. The babies that we see in hospitals and on the TV and in movies, they're crying and screaming because they're scared. They're terrified. There's bright lights and people are yelling and they're taken away from their mom right away and people do rude things to them. You know, I mean, it's of course they're crying because they're scared.
They're scared.
But when babies are born at home and they go right up into mama's arms, they come out totally peaceful, wide awake, alert, looking around. They're not drugged, right? Because mom's not drugged, and they are beaming like little Buddhas. I mean, they are just absolutely ecstatic. And they're looking around, and everybody who's at the birth is in this ecstatic field together. It's really an amazing experience. And I know most people, we didn't get born that way. We didn't have it when we were born. If we've birthed, we probably didn't have it when we birthed. But that's the hardwiring. That's the biological template, that we would be born in a peaceful, loving environment, held in our mama's arms, brought to the breast, that we would nurse. And you watch babies, especially infants, nurse that haven't been traumatized in any way. And again, they're ecstatic. sister will list out. And that template is in all of us. It's just about finding it or refinding it, reclaiming it, opening those pathways that have gotten closed up. But it's truly in there. I mean, think about all of animals in nature. We're all drawn to pleasure, right? As babies or kittens or puppies, they're drawn to the pleasure of nursing, to being licked, to being cuddled. You watch a mama cat with her kittens, she's purring and ecstatic. The kittens are nursing and they're ecstatic because pleasure is good. Pleasure is healthy.
Yes.
Connection and touch and warmth and love and nourishment, all good, pleasurable things that we're innately drawn to because that's what gives us life.
It gives us life. And I gave vaginal birth to a daughter and to a son. My daughter was premature, and while it was all natural childbirth and not too long a labor or anything like that, and I watched her birth, remembered my glasses so I could see her coming out. But because she was premature, they took her away. This was Stanford Hospital, for about an hour, just to observe her. And of course she was fine, but I didn't like that. And it was very different from when my son was born. 7 minutes after I got to the hospital, they tell you that sometimes a second children are fast. And so I was, I barely had a chance to be in the room and an intern or a resident. And she looked very much like a dyke. I didn't care. She said, "Put your feet up on my shoulders," which I did, and I pushed, nice. And out came my son. And he went right to my breast. He was full term, and it was just lovely. And, you know, I have a close relationship with both my kids who are, you know, adults now, but it was an amazing experience. And I know you're a mother, too, that that experience of having a child come out of you, it's miraculous, and the immediate love.
Isn't it crazy how much we love them?
Yeah.
I mean, at least most of the time, most people. And again, it's part of our hardwiring, right? Because otherwise the species wouldn't survive. Unless we have to fall helplessly in love with them, because otherwise, you know, babies are such a pain in the butt.
Well,
they're
they need so much care.
Right? So we're programmed to fall in love with them. And to give and receive pleasure. And again, bringing it back kind of full circle to the, you know, our adult relationship with ourselves and our own sexuality. I do wonder, about all the different things that have interfered with what should be a pleasurable, happy, healthy, self-loving, self-sexual relationship. And there's so many things that arise in our culture that get in the way of that, starting when we're little. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those differences depending on if you have a vulva or if you have a penis. But if you have a penis, when you're a baby and you're touching it, and then you're a toddler and you're touching it, we encourage our little boys to touch their penis because we want them to aim when they pee. Right?
That's a very good point.
Right? Yeah. They're going to touch it multiple times a day. Every time they go pee, they're going to touch their own genitals. We encourage that, and we also kind of laugh about the fact that, you know, they get little hard-ons, and they put the little hands on the little hard-ons, and we're like, oh, you know, boys will be boys. We're actually quite, you know, not only tolerant of that, but like I said, we want them. We want them to pee in the body, so they're
right.
touching themselves. And it's so different for vagina owners, right? Vulva owners, because we don't have to touch ourselves to pee. When we wipe, we're using toilet paper. And just you just watch what happens when a little toddler girl sticks her hand in her crotch, and the reactions of the adults around her. It's going to be, you know, bad. It's going to be shame. It's going to be don't do that, bad girl. Don't do that there. You know. And so it's it's not surprising to me that that young women are not self-pleasuring as much because we've gotten that message so firmly, not to go there. Don't go down there.
It's all true, and so self-pleasuring is, well, as you say, little boys from the beginning hold their penises, and little girls not so much. They don't touch their vulvas or their clitorises. But we know now, because we can look in utero, that babies are masturbating occasionally.
Yeah. And little girl babies just as much as little boys.
Exactly.
So it's not biological. It's cultural, that messaging that we give our girls about not doing that terrible, awful, you know, self-touching thing. And then there's, you know, there's religious messages around it, and
Lots of religious messages around it. When I was at UCLA's Female Sexual Medicine Center, there was one practicing Catholic woman in her 30s who was a client of mine, and the only way she could reach orgasm, because she was told time and time again growing up, don't touch down there, so she learned to lie on her stomach on a carpet and rock. And she could reach orgasm that way, but it's not especially partner compatible. And
so. Yeah, well, I've worked with a number of women who have a similar thing, or maybe a pillow, but it's that sort of lying on their belly, tightening their thigh muscles, and rocking. And I've had a number of women, often who figured this out quite young, but basically it's a pathway they developed, just what we were talking about before. And and they were wanting to be able to get aroused and be orgasmic in different positions and with partners. And that's why, again, I think the solo sex is so important, because when working with them, what I the home play assignments that they got were about creating more pathways, expanding what's possible, and that's, I just emphasize that so much. So again, for women who've maybe learned to have orgasms with a vibrator but haven't figured out how to do it other ways, or women who want to learn how to have something like an orgasm with intercourse, which, as you and I know, the majority of women don't have orgasms that way. But these are all things we can learn once we realize that we can train ourselves to expand our pathways and start getting to the point where we have what I call mastery of our erotic energy, where we can get turned on and be orgasmic with lots of different kinds of stimulation. And again, it's all learnable, just like a musician can learn to play lots of different kinds of music on their instrument if they practice.
Practice is very useful.
Understanding that this is learnable, I think that's the other piece, right? That a lot of people are walking around feeling kind of broken, like there's something really wrong with them, but it's broken and it's never going to be fixed. Instead of somebody saying to them, "Oh, there's just some stuff you haven't learned yet. Here's some of the things. Here's what you got. Here's how you can work with it. Here's how you play with it.
We haven't learned this quite yet.
Practice that."
Yeah, I certainly experience that in my practice, as I'm sure you do. I mean, you just haven't learned it yet, haven't practiced it yet. But then there are some other things, like I think a lot of people think that self-pleasuring may be an excuse for not having partner sex, or maybe a backup plan in case our partners fail. And so I think we need to remember that solo sex is indeed the safest, most uncomplicated, and most easily satisfying form of sex. You don't have to worry about a partner. It's really a great way to learn about. Let's expand a little bit more about that, Sherry, in our discussion.
Learning
your own responsiveness.
Yeah, and again, with the back to the piano analogy, if you're playing by yourself, you don't have to worry about what's going on with the other musician. If you're playing a duet, you've always got to be thinking, what's the other musician doing, and is our music working together, and should I be, helping them play their flute instead of playing my piano, and there's just so many other things going on with another person. You can't put all your attention on yourself when there's someone else there. You have to share the attention and pay attention to them, and so when you're just having sex with yourself, you don't have to worry that somebody else is getting bored, or you're not doing it right, maybe you should be paying more attention to them. So you just get rid of all of the other stuff that happens when you're playing with a partner. You just can focus on yourself. And really, what I think one of the important things about learning is about really thinking that what we're trying to learn is how to go inside of ourselves and find the connections, find what connects up and create those pathways. And so you, when you're doing it by yourself, you can just completely bring your focus inside, not have to pay attention to anyone else. And I think that that's learning how to go into our own solo erotic trance. Arousal is a trance state. It's an altered state of consciousness.
Yes,
and,
it is.
And it's a lot easier to go there solo than it is to do that with a partner. That's a higher level skill. And skills build on each other. So the more skilled I get at going into my solo erotic trance, the easier it's going to be then to do that with a partner presence.
Right, because the solo practice is a rehearsal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very possibly for being able to let go, to surrender with a partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, the more you practice it, the easier it gets.
Mm-hmm.
So when you practice it a lot by yourself, then it's going to be more likely that you're going to be able to go into that altered state with another person present, which is another set of skills, right?
I've also had female clients, because I work a lot with pre-orgasmic women, and so they'll say that, well, I was so eager to please my partner, because we female types are often raised with the idea that we need to please.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll say, well, I never focused on my own pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't. And then that combined, especially for younger women with body image issues, is a recipe for not having very good sex.
Yeah, and I've actually had a few clients, male clients, who had a similar problem.
Oh, male clients.
They were so, focused on giving their female partner pleasure that they weren't getting the stimulation that they needed. So that can go either way.
Yeah,
and,
good point.
And I think the other piece of this is that we've got generations now who are being raised on pornography.
Yeah,
and that is all about not real sex, but what people's idea of what sex is supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a lot of people kind of acting out what they've seen on porn, and lo and behold, it doesn't really work that well.
No, because porn is a very bad educator.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discussed last week on this program with Dr. Dudley Danoff, who is a renowned urologist, There's a new acronym, PIED, porn-induced erectile dysfunction.
And
it seems like a lot of young men, and I have a couple of them in my practice, 26, 27, professional men, fit, attractive, and they're experiencing ED because they've watched porn since they were maybe 13 or 14 because they're in that age range where it was available, streaming porn. And so they can't seem to get aroused by a real woman. And in fact, their brains may have been altered, you know, rewired somehow. Because when you're a teenager, your brain is still developing. So if there's if there's a lot of porn viewing, and your response is just to this kind of fantasy woman on the screen, that's going to be difficult to when you want to just relate to a real woman.
Yeah, I think we're raising some generations of people who are having more and more trouble with relating to an actual human being, since not only is there porn, but you know, a lot of they're connecting over social media and texting, so that actually being, you know, in your body with another person who's in their body and trying to figure out how to share pleasure is confusing, and again, it's we get back to the same pathway idea that these pathways that porn has developed get imprinted. We know it's a terrible teacher of technique, so you know, doing the techniques you see in porn generally don't please and stimulate a partner that well. And then there's also the kind of the thing about porn. When you're watching it by yourself, is you really are in your solo trance, right? There's not another human being to deal with at all, so you have no skills of communicating or, you know, knowing how to share an erotic space. So it seems to be, and I'm not anti-porn. I just want to say that I'm not against
porn. Of course, nor am I.
It can be a wonderful tool in our toolkit, but when it's the only way, the only pathway that you're using, and also here's the other thing, you can find your exact specific fantasy, you know, like whatever the script is that turns you on, you can find that in porn, and then you can just, you know, go through that same sexual script, and then that you get really limited. You get more and more limited at what can turn you on, and you get sort of affixed to being able to just have this very particular scenario play out. And again, real sex is it's an improvisation, right? Right? When we're with another person, we're co-creating this erotic dance, and it doesn't follow a script. And so I think that's another part of the problem.
I agree with you, Sherry. Let's go back to your wonderful book. And I said at the top of the show, I've recommended it to clients just, and they love it. Succulent Sex Craft. And so we were going to also talk about solo pleasuring, self-pleasuring, and sexual skills. And I think that sexual skills are like, and I know you agree, they're like any other skills. They're not magically inherited. They have to be learned. And that self-pleasuring is our first natural sexual activity. And we touched on this earlier. It's the way we discover our erotic feelings, the way we learn to like our genitals and to build sexual self-esteem. It's really the best way, isn't it, to get sexual self-knowledge and to let go of perhaps old sexual fears and inhibitions. So let's focus, because you do this in your book, about skills. Skills.
Yeah, let's talk about skills. So
okay, let's talk about skills.
So the way I look at it is that we've got all these inner tools, these inner skills, or we could call them instruments or abilities or capacities. Any of those words work. But it's stuff we're all born with. It's inside us, but we might not have learned how to use those things consciously to increase our arousal and expand our orgasms and have more pleasure. So I look at it as that we have tools of the body, the mind, the heart, and the spirit.
Hmm.
And some examples would be our body tools are things like our breathing,
mm-hmm.
sound, movement, vision, taste and smell, and touch.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have tools of the mind, like our awareness and our intention and what we pay attention to and our imagination. And we have tools of the heart,
mm-hmm.
Which are our love skills. And I want to be clear here that all of these skills are things we can use solo and then also use with partners. So, for example, our love skills start with our self-love, our ability
mm-hmm.
to love ourselves, to forgive, to give and receive, to be open-hearted.
Mm-hmm.
These are all love skills, but that begins with our relationship with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then these are the same skills we use with a partner. So we can use our breath by ourselves to get more turned on, to get more relaxed, to expand our pleasure. We can use sound with ourselves. And we can use those same tools with a partner. With a partner, we could breathe together. We could make sounds together. So all of these skills have multiple levels. But again, starting with ourselves gives us the opportunity to become skilled with them. So learning how to use my breath to enhance my own arousal is going to be useful when I'm self-pleasuring, as well as useful when I'm with a partner. So that's kind of the map. Oh, and then there are spiritual skills, I think, how we make things sacred and or special. And so those are our big tool buckets.
Well, so spiritual might come after love skills, or they're part of love skills.
Because
you've got breathing awareness.
Bucket.
What?
So I think our spiritual skills are how we make things sacred. That if we're talking about tool buckets or toolkits,
yeah.
I think we've got body, mind, heart, and spirit.
Right. Okay.
And
yeah.
So our spiritual skills, how we make things sacred, and that might be by holding the intention that it's sacred.
Mm.
And just that alone, for example, if somebody wanted to heal the relationship with their genitals, they don't love their own genitals, they think they're ugly or funny looking or yucky in some way, if they wanted to use their spiritual skills, maybe they would create an altar. A physical representation of a beautiful drawing or flowers, and then maybe they would light a candle, and that would be part of a ritual, and they would hold the intention that every part of my body is sacred, my genitals are sacred, my pleasure is sacred, and then they might have a self-love session where they've created this sacred space to do it in. And they could bring in some of their love skills. I love my body. I love my genitals. And then they would use their body skills. They would be breathing into their genitals. They might touch, put one hand on their genitals and one hand on their heart,
mm-hmm.
and imagine a circuit connecting them.
Yeah.
They might make sounds of pleasure and notice how sounds of pleasure expand our perception of pleasure. Right, we literally get more pleasure by making sound. I mean, we turn on more of our brain's receptive capacity when we do that. And so that would be a way of incorporating lots of these skills, playing with our awareness, noticing what thoughts arise when we start to self-pleasure. It might be that you notice negative thoughts arising and you use a technique to replace them with positives. That would be using some mind skills. And then again, since we all of these things are right inside us that we can call on any time, we might start with sound and breath, mm-hmm. And then add the things that seem most resonant. You know, like I think everyone should start with what seems easiest to them. So for someone that might be creating a ritual, for somebody else, you know, ritual would be like, yeah, no, I don't believe in that. That doesn't mean anything to me. So it would be like, great, don't use those tools. What tools work for you? Sound, movement, awareness, and imagination. So it's, mm-hmm. you know, we can all play with all of these different tools or instruments depending on which ones really call to us. So that's kind of the big picture of the tool.
That's a wonderful big picture, and it's very, the way you describe it, there's lots of permission givingness, and of course your book gives that too. If you can't do it this way, you could do it that way, and what mm-hmm. feels good to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in my practice, permission giving is often important. And that's because so many people do come out of a place of shame mm-hmm. and just really difficult families of origin and early mm-hmm. experiences and so on.
Mm-hmm. I that's a really important piece. I think of that as one of our heart skills, which is about loving ourselves, giving ourselves permission. And we can do this for other people in our practices, mm-hmm. and ultimately people do have to do it for themselves, right?
So
I used to, when I worked in a clinic, and I would be seeing patients, and sometimes, you know, women would tell me, you know, I don't have orgasms, right? They're in mm-hmm. there for the pap smear, but they would tell me because, you know, they felt safe with me. And so I would ask them, I'd say, well, do you masturbate? Do you have sex with yourself? And usually they would say no, and often mm-hmm. with a kind of like, yeah. Ooh, no, yuck. And so I would say to them, well, the way to learn to have orgasms is to play with yourself, to have sex with yourself, and that's how you're going to learn. And then I would take out my prescription pad, and I would write on my prescription pad, you know, masturbate or solo sex, whatever term I was using at the time, you know,
right.
minimum 3 times a week, sign it and hand it to them as
right.
a way of giving them permission.
Exactly.
And I hope that helped some of them.
I'm sure it did. Now, you know, the sex toys often can be useful
mm-hmm.
because they vibrate at 300 RPMs faster than any finger or tongue or penis can go for a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turns out, and this is fairly current data,
mm-hmm.
that there is a $15 billion industry in sex toys that's expected to reach $52 billion by 2020. Isn't that amazing? And
it's amazing, yeah, and also
yeah.
it makes sense, right?
Yeah. So, and then we know certain things now that we didn't know recently, that investing in a silicone toy is healthier for
mm-hmm.
the vagina and lasts longer and makes after-play cleanup easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of medical grade silicone.
Yep.
And I just want to say about for sex toys in general, especially
uh-huh.
for women, especially around vibrators,
mm-hmm.
we still have some cultural myths we have to get rid of.
Okay,
so
we talk about that, Carrie.
So one myth is, well, first of all, for a lot of women, the easiest path to learning to have orgasms involves a vibrator. But we still have a lot of women who feel kind of ashamed about that. Like, I'm not a real woman if I can only have an orgasm with a vibrator. So the first thing to say is, any path to orgasm is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you
yes.
use the path that you establish, and you build off of that, and you expand off of that, so you get develop more pathways. So you don't have to be dependent on a vibrator, because there are a number of women who can have orgasms with a vibrator, but have not been able to then learn how to use their hands or have an orgasm with a partner in some other way. So again, this is that learning thing. So the vibrator will not ruin you.
Well,
it won't make
you
said, it so
what
you
is the word you used? Ruin?
Ruin. Somebody
yeah,
that will
right,
ruin
right.
me. Or damage the head of your clitoris. I have people who think it will cause nerve damage and that it will be damaged forever, that you'll never be able to have partner sex. And so all of those are just myths.
Of course
all
they
of the
are.
Things, you know, learning how to have orgasms in lots of different ways is learnable. Vibrator can be a wonderful tool. It can be a wonderful tool to bring in with partner sex. There's a lot of people who feel like, oh, if I need my vibrator with partner sex, there's something wrong with me, or there's something wrong with my partner, or partners might feel threatened by that. So I would love to invite people to just get over all of that stuff. They're toys. You can use them. They can make things easier. They can act as an accelerator. You can use them alone. You can use them with partners. You can expand beyond needing to use them. And it's also really fun to always have to have more options and more things to play with. So,
and then I also sometimes when I'm working with a couple and we talk about sex toys that they might introduce, and I'll say to the husband who sometimes is or the partner who sometimes mm-hmm. looking a little uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the sex toy can just be a friend. It doesn't have to be a competitor. The
uh-huh.
sex toy will not get tired. It can go on and on. And so that seems to relax a few of the men that I've seen.
Yeah, I also like to reassure them the sex toy is also never going to be cuddling and spooning
oh.
after sex or
well,
saying I love
indeed.
You.
Well,
right?
Yeah. No,
not
the
gonna
sex
replace
toy is
you.
Never going to replace an actual wonderful penis or wonderful
uh-huh.
lips and tongue or
mm-hmm.
Connection, the connection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, it won't.
Yeah.
But, of course, women can learn to have orgasms with a vibrator. And I going back to when I worked years ago with these pre-orgasmic women's groups, sometimes we encouraged the women to do a vibrator fast, just because fingers were mm-hmm. a little more, so we'd encourage them to self-pleasure with fingers mm-hmm. because that was a little more partner compatible. But
mm-hmm.
whatever works.
Yeah, what I like to suggest is what I call kind of a cross-training thing.
Okay,
so
talk about that.
Whatever path you found to orgasm, say it's a woman and her easy path to orgasm is using a vibrator predominantly on the head of her clitoris, which would be a common pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would like to suggest to that woman is, so use your vibrator and get yourself to, like, medium-level arousal.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, be enhancing your breathing, making some sound, pulsing your pelvic floor muscles, rocking
right.
your hips. These are some of our using your tools. And then when you're at about medium arousal, just take off the vibrator and switch to using your fingers for
a
couple
of minutes.
That's
a very good idea, yes.
Right? And see if with the breathing and the sound and your fingers and your pulsing your pelvic floor muscles, see if you can just keep your arousal level up. And maybe
mm-hmm.
even get it higher. And then if it starts to drop back down, just put the vibrator back on. And just intermittently stop using the vibrator and
mm-hmm.
use your fingers a little bit. And then go back to the vibrator. But also be using your other tools. Be using those other, especially the key tools of breath, sound, movement. And after a while, you're going to start to discover that you leave the vibrator off for longer and longer. And then you're going to get more, and then you've developed a new pathway. And it's the same technique you can use with learning to have orgasms with intercourse, which might involve clitoral stimulation with a vibrator during intercourse and with orgasm. And then you do that a bunch of times, and then you have a bunch of times where you intermittently stop using the vibrator but keep using your other tools. And sooner or later, you start training your mind, body, and the pathways so that the vibrator becomes something that you don't use most of the time. And then there still might be a time where you're just not getting there, or, you know, you're tired, or you want to be really efficient, and you can whip out your trusty vibrator. So that's what I suggest. And so use the pathway that works, and then, you know, you step off it. Or you do a parallel path. Like if you want to learn to have orgasms from nipple stimulation, use your vibrator or whatever, you know, sort of hands-on or, you know, whatever kind of genital stimulation works. Maybe it's your partner's hands or mouth or something. And you do nipple stimulation at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you intermittently stop the genital stimulation while continuing the nipple stimulation. And if you do that over time, at a certain point, you're just going to be able to do the nipple stimulation and get off on that. You know, it's like Pavlov's dog, right? We know the basic operant conditioning experiment where, you know, they every time they fed the dog, they rang a bell, and then after a while, they would ring the bell, and the dog would start to salivate. Well, we're exactly like that. So we just can train ourselves.
That's
how we can train ourselves to be orgasmic from almost anything.
And in my advanced age, I've learned that too. And
mm-hmm.
it's been
mm-hmm.
just wonderful, including anal pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a whole other area, right?
Yeah. And I haven't, this is maybe too much information. I hope my children aren't listening. Not actual anal penetration, but some, and a finger more than penis. And there are all those nerve endings.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually with my fiance Brian, I've learned that that can be pleasurable, and I never knew that before I was, let's say 50, maybe even 60. So I'm very much aware that you can learn, you can establish these new pathways, and it can be a lot of fun.
Well, you know, in terms of nerve endings, if we look at the amount of nerve endings as equating to our pleasure potential, our genitals are certainly number one on the hip parade. Our anus is number two. It is. There's so many nerve endings in and around the anus, and amazing pleasure can be had there. It's a unisex orifice. Everybody's got one. We also have tremendous shame and taboo around it. At the same time, because of porn, anal sex has now become a much more standard part of people's sexual activities, often with women being on the receiving end. And a lot of them are not having pleasure with it. They're having a lot of pain and discomfort, and they're doing it because that's what they see on porn. They're doing it the way they see it done on porn, which is probably the worst possible way to enter an anus, the porn way. And that's really a shame because that's training the body in the wrong direction. That's training the body for pain and tension and closure, and the anus is not going to ever get to the pleasure place if it's getting, you know, kind of assaulted that way. So it's, again, another area where there's tremendous potential for pleasure. And I like to encourage people, if you have not explored that in your solo play, that's the place to do it with your own, you know, with a finger of your own that's well lubricated. You can put on a glove, makes it clean easy. Or a small toy, a small anal plug, and I will
exactly.
note that anything you put in your butt has to be designed for your butt. It has to have a flange.
Right.
You don't want things that are going to disappear up there, because otherwise there can be a very embarrassing emergency room visit in your future.
So, and apparently
that's
fairly common.
For
I hear that from stories about
sure.
emergency
yeah.
rooms. So, yeah, we have
yeah.
to be a little careful.
Yeah. So, right. So get a little butt vibrator or a little butt plug, and during your solo sex, when you're already highly aroused, then add a little anal stimulation. Do it when you're in the shower or the bathtub, right? And then when you start to realize, oh, this feels good, then with a partner that you have good communication with, then you say, okay, next time we're playing, just a little bit of stimulation just around the outside of my anus, and then maybe just a little tiny tip of a finger just inside a little bit. And that's how you connect with the pleasure. And once you connect with your own anal pleasure, then there's potential for lots of fun things to do with your butt.
a lot of fun things. Well, you are such a fun guest, and I am so delighted, Sherry, that we're going to do a part two on the 27th of September. And you and
That's
I
awesome.
Will talk off the air about the topic for that. But the lovely thing about you is, you talk so articulately about everything, and your book
Thank
is
you.
Great. And you've done the book, Succulent Sex Craft, with your partner in life, Carl Frankel, who's also been on this program. So there's the music, Sherry. Thank you so much for this last hour. It's been great.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you, Sherry. Bye, everybody.
My boy Getty.